calling the first appeal for oral argument, and that is Joseph Wallace versus Superintendent of Mahanoy SCI, Attorney General. Mr. Saylor, you want to go forward for the petitioner, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sam Saylor. And may it please the court, I would ask for 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. No judge, state or federal, has ever reviewed Joe Wallace's post-conviction claim. He's never had a hearing, he's never had an opportunity to present the merits of these claims. At each stage of this case, Mr. Wallace's mental illness has stood in the way, and it has rendered him unable to file for over a decade. And it is also deeply related as to why his conviction is unconstitutional.
Let's just see what we can agree upon, please, for purposes of setting the time frame, or at least one of them here. Are we agreed that Mr. Wallace did not file his habeas corpus petition within the one-year period under AEDPA, and that it was due on January 7 of 2002.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's
right. And do we agree that he asks for equitable tolling of a 13 years and 9 month period? That would be until he actually filed on September 29 of 2015.
That is correct, John.
So with respect to the equitable tolling request, I'm curious as to what it is you contend for purposes of tolling. Is it that during that 13 years and 9 month period my previous question referred to, he had no period or periods of lucidity such that he could have filed for habeas?
That's exactly what we're contending, Your Honor.
But he did, during that period of time, file a PCRA.
He did, with the substantial assistance with other inmates.
He would have had more substantial assistance if it had been filed by counsel. But how is that a point of any importance here?
Well, Your Honor, I think we have to look at exactly what Mr. Wallace was experiencing at the time, which was he had just emerged from a padded cell in SCI Brackville.
Well, at which time? Again, we're talking about a 13 year and 9 month period of time here. So during which you contend and responded affirmatively to my question, he was unable, that it was impossible for him, that's the word you use, to have filed for habeas relief at any point in time. So what point on this particular time frame are you referring to when he had just emerged from a padded cell?
Well, in 2013, in which he filed his state PCRA, he had just emerged from psychiatric observation cell, and actually a few different psychiatric observation cells. The medical records reflect that he had been descending into paranoia and delusions.
Don't the records also show that during this lengthy period of time, he had a prison job of some kind, 2009?
He had some responsibilities in prison, although those were quickly taken away from him. And I think that we can see affidavits that he has submitted both himself as well as the medical records show that he was heavily medicated. In fact, in 2012, the DOC medical records say that his increasing delusions and paranoia were maybe as a result of being over-medicated and having his medications changed around.
Mr. Submitted. Mr. Saylor, I don't want to monopolize here, and I want to turn this over quickly to my colleagues, Judge McKee and Judge Ambrose. But I've reviewed the medical records, and I assume that you know what a GAF is. By that, I mean the acronym GAF, the Global Assessment of Functioning.
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Would you agree that there was considerable variance in Mr. Wallace's reported GAF during his period of incarceration, and that in fact there were periods that he was said to be doing pretty well, that he was in partial remission at least?
The references to remission, Your Honor, are, from what I can tell from the medical records, happens three times. There is just the purpose of his functioning within DOC custody. He's not at that point violent or a threat to himself or others. He quickly descends into that kind of state very soon after that. So while he may have been controlled, have his symptoms controlled, he was essentially so over-medicated to be functionally useless.
Is that what the records show throughout? That he was over-medicated and functionally useless? I mean, isn't that what psychotropics are for, rather, to treat symptoms? And that, in fact, they were treated in such a way that on numerous occasions, he was observed by professionals to be in remission, to be looking stable, to be okay with my meds, he said.
He also reported having a blunt affect, a flat affect. There's an affidavit that's produced in the objections from a friend, Annette Connor, who says that Mr. Wallace was extremely slow. There's an affidavit from his sister, Christy Primus, who in 2013 says when communicating with him on the phone that he was incomprehensible, that he was slow, and that he appeared to be still in the throes of mental illness. Such the fact that she disregarded any of the mailings that she gave to him. So I think
wasn't
there's
there a period between 2007 and 2009 where he was basically lucid and functioning. That seemed to me to be the crucial period that you may have a problem in terms of ethical tolling.
There are three references to him being in remission, Your Honor. And those are, again, three references for purposes of being in DOC custody, and they're not for evaluating whether he can file a federal habeas petition. And I think the clearest evidence that he's not lucid is that he doesn't file anything during that time.
Well, but that twist of evidence, that you can't say that.
That's pretty circular.
Yeah, it really is, because then everything would be equitable tolling. There's no filing, therefore he must not have been lucid. That may be the weakest argument that we'll hear today. That can't be true.
Well, I would say that in that time period, his medication had been increased over a number of years. In 2001, for instance, when he first entered into DOC custody, he was experiencing, according to DOC medical professionals, pseudo-dementia and looking over-medicated. And from that point, his medication has only increased. 75% increase of Risperdal, which is a very powerful psychotropic medication. These medications can dull your effect.
Right, but in 2007, I thought they've got the medications right. They reduced the medications to have a more verbal and interactive effect. And that lasted, I guess, until 2009. Then there were some problems in 2009 and became heavily medicated again. Is that incorrect?
From Mr. Wallace's affidavit, again, we're talking about records in which there's maybe a page or two total of recording from that time period. Mr. Wallace's affidavit says that he was essentially too slow and too over-medicated to comprehend his any sort of post-conviction remedies at that time. There's a visitor, you know, that I referenced earlier, Annette Connor, who visited him in 2009, that says how slow and inarticulate and dull he was. He compared him to a common friend who was on a lot of medication and a lot of drugs. So actually, my understanding is that the medication had risen into that 2007-2009 period, and then it began to wean him off of that. And then at that point, he began to descend again into more of the throes.
Your position sounds like if he's not on medication, he's in bad shape. He's not fully capable, not fully competent. And if he is on medication, he's dulled and he's not fully competent. That's pretty much of a catch-22, at least for purposes of trying to analyze a request of this kind for equitable tolling.
Well, I think Your Honor can appreciate that mental illness is never a linear, never a straightforward analysis by doctors. I think they were just trying to get it right. And I think they had over-medicated him at that point. They over-medicated him.
Can I jump in here? I like to work backward. Let's assume for the moment that he was completely incompetent until March 2013. And supposedly after March of 2013, he was doing a lot better. In fact, within a few months later, he filed a PICRA petition. And you've dealt with it very briefly in your reply brief, including in a footnote on page six or so that you're arguing for equitable tolling. But let's assume that equitable tolling begins. He becomes mentally competent in March of 2013. Therefore, he needs to file something by March of 2014 in terms of federal habeas. However, what he files in the interim is a clearly out of time PICRA petition with the help of a person in prison. That is denied for being out of time on July 29th of 2015, and then 2 months later he files the federal habeas. But the federal habeas is now two and a half years after March of 2013. To get equitable tolling, you need two things. You need diligence. Let's assume that he was diligent during that time period. But if the extraordinary circumstances, the mental incompetence, ceases in March of 2013, how do you fit that wrong after March of 2014?
Well, Your Honor, setting aside the diligence, which I think Mr. Wallace was diligent.
My question is, how do you go extraordinary circumstances after March of 2013?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think there is numerous on the record indications that he was still experiencing extraordinary circumstances by way of mental illness.
On the advice is they filed a PICRA petition. Does the PICRA petition, which was clearly out of time, does that retoll the time period for filing a habeas?
At this point, no. And that's the state of the law is that it does not toll because the state courts also found it out of time.
So then what happens is you have to file either a habeas, go straight to a habeas, or file a protective habeas as a placeholder, and neither one of those occurred within the 1 year period after March of 2013.
That's correct. He was relying on inmates heavily, on other inmates to advise him and to essentially file these things for him. The evidence shows that Mr. Danish,
if he was capable of reaching out to a fellow inmate, if he was capable of holding a job for a period of time. If he was, as the records demonstrate, from time to time in partial remission, doing pretty well. At one point, there was a suggestion in the record, this is December 18 of 07, in full remission. Why couldn't he have somehow attempted to reach out to counsel, since you are continually arguing that his use of a fellow inmate's expertise, so to speak, was inadequate?
Well, he was not represented by counsel in 2007 to 2009. He was represented by
I didn't say he was. My question is, he could reach out and have sought counsel, right? Don't you think he was competent to do that?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Let me focus on a broader question here, if I may. And that is, what is it that you're seeking? My understanding is that the appeal here is really the refusal of the district court to grant an evidentiary hearing and provide funds for the selection or for seeking an expert. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so what is it that you would do, and what did you tell the district court you would do if you were granted that relief?
If we were granted in terms of the equitable tolling, if your honors are have some doubts, which it sounds like you may, about the record as it is, we would ask for an evidentiary hearing.
Speaking only for myself, I have very little doubt about what the records show, and they show it at various points in time. So what is it that retrospectively you would attempt to have some third party who did not have contact with Mr. Wallace at that point in time contribute to the question of reopening the record, and reopening for what?
Well, when Mr. Wallace presented this information to the district court, one of the best ways at that point was to resolve it, was to hold a hearing. And that wasn't done. And that left the magistrate judge having to essentially gap fill and interpret some of these.
My question was, what if you had been granted that hearing, what would you have done? What would you have shown, or what would you have asked to show?
Well, I would have asked to put on expert testimony to educate a court about Mr. Wallace's bipolar I disorder, in which he's experiencing bouts of paranoia and delusions.
And he had that back at the time, contemporaneous with the killing here, right? And
I'm sorry, if you repeat your question.
Did he not have that condition? Was he not suffering from those very conditions back at the time of the killing of his wife?
Yes, he was.
And both doctors, Cook and Sadoff, have opined that his condition would not have met the McNaughton test. Don't they say that in their respective reports?
Yes, they do.
So the attorney here he had as defense counsel in the homicide prosecution, apparently prevailed in having the Commonwealth take the death penalty off the table, or maybe the Commonwealth decided that on its own, and was successful in negotiating a plea down from murder one to murder three. This was an experienced defense counsel, wasn't it? 27 years, and the person in the office who handled all or most of the mental health cases, isn't that what the record shows?
That's correct, Your Honor. The Commonwealth took off the death penalty before any sort of negotiation began. I think the crux of this goes to the actual innocence argument, and the fact that counsel never investigated this link between Ritalin, the stimulant-induced psychosis, which when contextualized with other evidence that counsel could have produced and had in his possession, including mental records to the 1980s.
I'm struggling as I have been since my first contact with this case, is with the Ritalin issue. And putting aside the doubts that I concede I have as to whether this was newly discovered evidence, because I remember just anecdotally from my own reading back in the 90s about news that Ritalin could have an adverse effect on children with an existing medical condition or psychiatric condition. But again, putting that aside, what difference does the Ritalin make here? It's merely a causative agent. And if it acted on Mr. Wallace the way you're suggesting that it might have, the manifestations were still the same. You'd still end up with the same expert report, would you not? The same expert opinion. That is that he was severely mentally ill, that he was psychotic, that he was bipolar. How does that change anything?
In 2013, Dr. Cook, who was one of the evaluating doctors in 2000, said that Ritalin could be exacerbated with psychosis. In order to pass through the actual innocence gateway, a petitioner must show new reliable evidence that is more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have convicted him in light of
the
new evidence.
Focus on the new. It's not newly discovered, though, is it? It's not. What does new mean? Is it newly discovered, or under Reeves, if it's known by counsel at the time but not presented, is that sufficient to come within the gateway?
Well, I believe under Reeves, the evidence was known at the time, but it was just not investigated by counsel. And okay. So that related to counsel's ineffectiveness.
That's
claim
why
in that
I wanted
case.
To
so that
focus
would be the same
in on
case
newly discovered.
Okay. It is newly discovered because counsel never investigated this link, even though he had in his possession documents that showed that Mr. Wallace's psychosis was likely triggered by stimulant use in the 1980s.
Your argument is, I think, that he should at least have a hearing to determine whether or not, given the record that's there now, there was ineffective assistance of counsel in terms of not presenting evidence to the court, which would have taken malice off the table, because for M1 and M3, yeah, he's out of the death penalty, but with murder 3, you still need the element of malice. You're arguing, I think, that there was evidence that should have been presented that would have negated the element of malice. Therefore, you get under the Schlupp case. That's, I think, what you're trying to tell us.
My argument regarding malice is that it was not a knowing plea for two different experts to say that he acted without malice, and Mr. Wallace was never apprised of this fact.
I think you may have just taken a strike on a softball. You know, I understand what you're saying, but as you can tell from the questions, it's not helping us a great deal. If we focus in on actual innocence as opposed to the equitable tolling, which, at least from my perspective, yeah, it's a harder argument. If you could show that there was evidence that wasn't introduced that would have taken malice off the table, out of the equation, even though it went from M1 down to M3, we really should be looking at maybe a manslaughter or maybe something else, and the McNaughton test then evaporates, doesn't it? Because we're not talking about innocent because he was legally competent under the McNaughton test. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought your argument was something besides McNaughton. Am I wrong about that?
My argument is that experts never had in their possession the fact that he was taking Ritalin, and that according to his psychologist, merely days before, that he was experiencing, that it was escalating. That Dr. Bebo, and just the day before he killed his wife, said to reevaluate his medications. At that point, his experts don't have that. Dr. Cook said he's never apprised of it.
So doesn't that position necessarily require that somehow taking Ritalin would exacerbate a pre-existing psychosis in a manner somehow different and separate from an existing psychosis worsening because of some other cause? Again, I don't understand how the causative agent has any impact here if the observations of the psychiatrist are based on, as they were here and always are, medical records that existed, what the patient told the physician, and the other information that is available to the physician about the patient. What changes just because he took Ritalin? And what did you offer to the district court in that regard to persuade the district court that you ought to be able to pursue such an issue that I admittedly don't understand?
Well, Mr. Wallace, in his pro se petition, raised the issue of actual innocence, and in his objections also raised it as well. I was not counsel below. So that issue was never briefed, and it was never argued at all. So we would argue at the very least we'd be entitled to an evidentiary hearing on that issue. Regarding the Ritalin, though, I think it's important that your honors understand that if all experts in the case were not aware of the Ritalin, then that sort of could have made difference to the jury feeling that, and that's the case under actual innocence. We actually get through the gateway there. Whether the evidence to a reasonable juror could have resulted in the conviction.
Okay, so how is that counsel's responsibility here? We have three psychiatrists, actually two psychiatrists and one psychologist, who examine Wallace fairly close to the event. And we all know what the opinions are. We also know that our jurisprudence is fairly deferential, it is deferential, I should say, to strategic decisions made by counsel. Now, there was a strategic decision here to suggest to Mr. Wallace that he plead to murder three rather than go to trial where he would have had exposure to murder one. Why is that ineffectiveness on the part of counsel? Since he made the suggestion he did. In fact, the record is clear that at one point he was considering going to trial, and then that changed. Isn't the responsibility of the docs here to thoroughly examine and inquire into medication if the medication has any relevancy at all to the manifestations of that apparently led to the homicide?
Well, counsel's failure to investigate any sort of link between the prescriptions can't be strategic under Wiggins, under Strickland, if there's no investigation at all. The fact that he pled him down to a lesser degree doesn't launder the lack of an investigation into a complete defense in the case.
So counsel should have sua sponte raised some psychopharmacological issue here that was not presented to him by the three psychiatric professionals who were consulted and rendered opinions. Is that what you're saying?
He should have recognized that based on what he had in his possession, including stimulant-induced psychosis from the 1980s, as well as comments in just the days before.
What would be the relevance of that? Let's say you're right that he should have recognized that. What do you then do with that evidence once you have it? How would that have made
it to the doctor? I think you have to. It's still counsel's job. I would still contend it's still counsel's job to properly meet and consult the expert. Make sure the expert has all the information that you need. Cook says he was never aware of it. Yes, it's. I would say it's absolutely counsel's job to apprise of that information. I don't think counsel can be presumed to be acting strategically if they aren't giving the full briefing or the full information to their own experts.
Why were Dr. Cook and Dr. Sadoff retained? Why were they asked to render an opinion?
From the records, Your Honor, I don't know. I believe, I guess I don't understand your question.
Sadov, Sadov has testified before me many, many times. He's the government psychiatric expert. I'm assuming that, and I'm not addressing this to my colleague, but to you, Mr. Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming he was brought in to establish mental competency.
That's right. And actually, both of them said that he was barely competent, and then Mr. Wallace's competency was never checked before.
But competent to do what? Let's focus in on that. Competent to do what?
To actually engage in formal trial proceedings or plea proceedings.
Okay. Does that examination that was done at the time, or did any examination inquire into whether or not he was mentally capable of having malice at the time he killed his wife? Looking at all the statements, I don't know how you get malice, just from my position, malice out of the statements other than the very fact of killing itself, which is not what the law of Pennsylvania recognizes as malice.
If I understand you, Your Honor, that's correct. Developed. Yes, the two defense experts said that he did not act with malice. And that both of them rendered that opinion to trial counsel. And then the information that I have is that...
Then how was counsel ineffective? If counsel has that information, he didn't act with malice, walk me through that. Then what does that do to your... What does that get you? What do you do with that?
Well, for one, it's... So I think it's two different problems. One is that it's a failure to present these malice opinions to Mr. Wallace to make a decision as to whether he wants to plead or not to a crime that whose element includes malice. And it's also, in making sure that the experts, again, I think this has to go back to the responsibility of trial counsel. And the responsibility of trial counsel is to make sure that his experts are fully briefed and fully updated on all of Mr. Wallace's medications, and also what the, for instance, the correct standard of malice is, and then to inform Mr. Wallace of what these experts say. And here there was a real disconnect there, a serious disconnect that resulted in a plea, while on its face was certainly to a lesser degree, but it was for the max penalty for third degree. So he received no real benefits to this other than taking first degree off the table.
That's a gigantic benefit. That's a huge benefit.
Absolutely. But it's Mr. Wallace's decision. It's ultimately Mr. Wallace's decision. And he was not given this decision in this context.
He was competent to make that decision, you're saying.
It's also until it's competent and aware enough to make this decision. Given the fact he was never reevaluated. And then only 20 days after his plea in DOC custody, the DOC doctors said that he was experiencing pseudo-dementia, looking over-medicated, and had an AXIS 5 diagnosis of 40, which is extremely low functioning. That AXIS 5 diagnosis then follows with him the rest of the time and comes back to equitable tolling. It never rises above 50. And while the AXIS 5 is not used in DSM-5, it was certainly used at that point as an indication of how low Mr. Wallace's function was, despite the fact that that his symptoms may have been in remission during 2007 to 2009.
Let me just, this will be my last inquiry before my colleagues ask whatever questions they wish to ask further of you. But doctors Cook and Sadov were not prosecution witnesses, were they? They were not retained by the prosecution.
No, by the defense, Your Honor.
Yes, they were defense witnesses. And did either or both of them indicate that what they were saying about malice was malice in the legal sense or malice in a more generic sense?
I think the contention from the Commonwealth is that they were using an incorrect definition for malice. I would say that their opinions, they're respected professionals, and that they could have testified to this lack of malice to a jury.
Well, what the Commonwealth did know, though, and what defense counsel would have known in going about negotiations here, is that the Commonwealth did have an expert witness, Dr. Michaels, right?
Yes, that's correct, John.
And Dr. Michaels did opine that Mr. Wallace, my opinion that Mr. Wallace knew that the stabbing and other injuries that he had inflicted on his wife were wrong and would cause her death. It is my understanding that malice is defined as, and then he, so he ultimately writes, it is my opinion that Mr. Wallace's killing of his wife was done with malice. Now, at trial, that could have been used to support a first-degree murder conviction, could it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So counsel had that in negotiating a plea here to murder three, because the Commonwealth, the prosecution, had an opinion in its pocket that could be presented for the purpose of showing malice, whether what the other docs were talking about was legal malice or malice in a more generic sense.
It's still not a knowing plea at that point.
Why?
Still,
right. Why isn't it?
I'm sorry?
I didn't know. No, you're stating a conclusion that it wasn't knowing. I'm asking why, given what the exchange was just then with the chief.
You know, Mr. Wallace was never told about these other malice opinions or the other lack of malice opinions before pleading guilty. You know, that's one of the major constitutional problems with this conviction, is that it's ultimately his decision. And while there may have been some negotiation as a result of the conflicting malice opinions, also a jury can hear what each doctor says. And I think
obviously, and if the jury had chosen to believe Dr. Michaels, then your client could have been convicted of murder one, which in this case would have required life imprisonment.
Yes, that's correct.
Judge McKee, Judge Ambrose, please. I know I've been asking a lot of questions. So
I have nothing further.
I'll wait till rebuttal. I have one question to follow up. I'll wait till rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Saylor. We will have you back on rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Mr. Casenta?
May it please the court, Nicholas Casenta, Chief Deputy District Attorney of Chester County. I want to start by responding to something Judge Smith just said with the conflicting expert opinions on malice. It's in the record that the suppression hearing that the prosecutor stated to Judge McElroy that she intended to file a motion to exclude defense testimony on certain issues. The actual motion's not in the record, but he said that was based on the malice, that the two experts of the defense were not using the legal definition of malice, and they should be precluded from then expressing those opinions because it wasn't based on Pennsylvania law. I want to get to this issue of the drugs. Dr. Sadoff lists all these drugs that the defendant says affected his mental state. Dr. Michaels was aware of them because he cites them also and says he read Dr. Sadoff's report. The PCRA counsel, Mr. Brenza, in this case, actually wrote to Dr. Cook to investigate this based on what Dr. Cook had said in another letter. And Attorney Brenza's letter is in the record, and it's dated August 25th, and it's on page 1415, and he's quoting from Dr. Cook. And Dr. Cook says, I wasn't aware of these drugs, and I believe they would have exacerbated his psychosis, but I still stick to my original opinion that he was not guilty. He wasn't McNaughton insane at the time, and he was competent to stand trial. So Dr. Cook said that these drugs may have exacerbated the condition, but they did not affect his overall opinion as to the defendant's mental state. And when we, the initial argument here was how much time should be equitably told. The way I read the record is from 2000 to 2009, the defendant was considered a relatively stable, and that his condition maybe started to deteriorate in 11 and 12. However, started his litigation in 13. So
Mr. Casenta,
when his condition had deteriorated, that's when he actually started the litigation.
Mr. Casenta, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me, Mr.
Yeah.
What does the record show, if anything? And I know this is an old record, and in fact, I believe we don't even have the colloquy of the plea available because of the age of the records, more to the point, because the portions of the record were just destroyed by the county along the way, as apparently in an ordinary culling process, unfortunately. But does anything in the record demonstrate just whether, and I'm talking about not only at the time of trial, but later in the PCRA, that what defense counsel was looking to do was to argue an involuntary intoxication defense here, or that could have been available because of the Ritalin information?
Yes, Your Honor, my argument is that when you look at the law of involuntary intoxication in Pennsylvania, it's an extremely limited defense.
Well, I was getting to that, but I didn't want to ask you. I asked you if there was anything in the record suggesting that that's the direction the defense was going in, because I'm not even sure that there is an involuntary intoxication defense. Maybe there is, but I know that Mr. Wallace has argued that the Pennsylvania Superior Court cases favorably view that. I'm not sure what they mean by that. We do know that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania has not recognized such a defense.
No, Your Honor, there was nothing in the record indicating that was on anybody's radar at the time. And when you read all the involuntary intoxication defenses, most of them, we'll assume it will exist for this purpose, but they're usually in the context of, well, if it did exist, who has the burden of proof? Or if it does exist, what's the correct jury? They never flat out have said, we have an involuntary intoxication defense here in Pennsylvania. And in those cases where they've actually discussed it, it's usually with DUI, and the standard jury instruction says only to be used in DUI cases.
Right. So it's limited to that.
Yes.
Can I ask a question on the just direction of polling? Our court has not issued a precedential opinion providing the factors for courts to consider in evaluating equitable tolling based on mental illness. What factors do you think we should adopt?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I think there has to be a finding that the mental condition was such that it would prevent the defendant, or I keep referring to it as defendant, I'm used to practicing in state court.
We understand.
The mental condition prevented him from acting in such a way as to exercise his rights. There has to be some type of link between the mental condition and not filing. And then there's got to be a due diligence component in that, because...
No, but what factors would you suggest that we consider if we have a not precedential opinion? Are you familiar with that case?
What was that again, Your Honor? I'm having trouble hearing you.
We have a not precedential opinion. PHAMPNEY. Are those factors you think we should consider?
I'm not that familiar with that case, Your Honor, but I do think it's got to be based on the mental condition, and that how that in fact prevented the defendant from exercising his rights in a timely manner.
Well, Champney is a not precedential opinion, but Mr. Cassenta, the petitioner has argued that case over about four pages of his brief. It's cited, on four pages. So it was relied upon to a considerable extent by Mr. Wallace. Yeah.
Your Honor, the approach I took when I was looking at the equitable tolling is I looked at the allegations and the as put forth by petitioner. And I said, okay, assuming all this is true, does it get him over the hump? And when I looked at it, basically their stability for at least 9 years. And then when he started litigating by his own admission when he was deteriorating.
Which 9 years?
From 2000 to 2009. Then his allegations were he started deteriorating again in 11 and got worse in 12. So we have a large swath of time here that it's not that they haven't established that he was incapable of doing filing a timely petition. If your honors don't have,
I mean, let's go back to the, I mean, the factors. If you look at pages 29 through 33 of the opening brief, it's front and center is trying to look at the Champman factors. You're telling me that you're not familiar with those. So I mean, we can go on, but that does seem to be a very important part of the equitable tolling argument put out by the public federal public defender.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have it right in front of me, and I can't recall that at this time.
All right.
But I'm assuming if this court has already issued that I'm sure that it was.
Well, no, it's not precedential. It's been used by a lot of district courts because it's the one thing that's out there, and it seems to be fairly uniform, but we have not adopted anything. But I was just trying to see if you had any thoughts as to help us hone our thinking with respect to the things that we should consider when we deal with equitable tolling in the case of mental illness.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just don't think I am qualified to speak on all that, but I don't disagree that you should be, the opinion you've been using so far is, I was familiar with it at the time I wrote my brief. Unfortunately, my memory is eluding me right now.
All right.
Unless Your Honors have any questions, I can rest on our brief.
Judge McKee. Judge Ambrose?
No questions.
All right. We'll have Mr. Saylor back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may start, I think I want to emphasize a few things. One is that I think there needs to be an evidentiary hearing, which is what I asked for in my brief regarding equitable tolling. There's no mention in, for instance, the magistrate judge opinion about any reference to the condition that bipolar disorder plays on, or the effect that the bipolar disorder has on someone's ability to file federally. There's no mention of the DSM-5. There's no mention of what the kind of impairments that a person like Mr. Wallace would experience. There is an interpretation of medical records, essentially in isolation. Again, I think we are placing a lot of emphasis on the word remission 2007, 2009, but we have affidavits to show that he was extremely slow and that even through the period after he filed his state
PCRA. Are you arguing for an evidentiary hearing for purposes of attempting to explain why there was not a more timely filing here? Or are you asking for an evidentiary hearing for purposes of demonstrating the mental condition of Mr. Wallace back at the time the plea was entered?
That's my question as well. I don't understand why you're focusing on equitable tolling hearing.
I could certainly focus on actual innocence. In terms of the actual innocence, I would also be asking for an evidentiary hearing. I think we, Mr. Wallace,
you don't just come in, Mr. Saylor, and say, I want an evidentiary hearing. Give it to me. I mean, you have to have some purpose because the burden of production here is going to be on you. What is it that you want to show? And I'm afraid I'm no more clear on that right now than I was when I entered the courtroom.
Regarding the actual innocence or the equitable tolling, Your Honor?
Tell me both.
Okay. The actual innocence, I would like to do exactly what Dr. Cook recommends in his 2013 letter, which is have a medical person with a medical degree review the effect of Ritalin on Mr. Wallace's bipolar disorder.
Where did Dr. Cook say that?
In his 2013 letter, Your Honor. wrote to ECRA counsel, and I'm sorry, it's not right in front of me, but I could certainly write the court with that information. But he wrote PCRA counsel and said that it could have exacerbated his condition and that we would need a medical doctor to confirm that. We would need a psychopharmacologist to confirm that, which is what
all right. So, but I go back to a question I've asked two or three times, and that is, what does the exacerbation of his condition as a result of having taken Ritalin do to help you here in terms of any defense that would be interposed? What difference does the causative agent, whether it's biochemical within Mr. Wallace himself and not some exogenous source, versus a reaction from a medication taken by him back at the time, around the time of the killing. What does that do for you? The manifestations remain the same. So so presumably the opinion is going to remain the same because it's based on what Mr. Wallace told the doctors, what they observed when they talked with him, the medical records that they themselves looked at. What is it that 21 years after the crime you think can be produced here that's helpful?
I don't think we can presume that the expert opinion would have been the same if Dr. Cook or Dr. Sadoff at the time had really examined that link between Ritalin and his psychosis. I think that's not
you don't you feel you have some burden to come in and tell the district court what it is you have based upon the universe of information and knowledge, pharmacological knowledge, with respect to Ritalin that is available now, available to you even without an opinion yet, and why that should support the grant of an evidentiary hearing?
Well, In my brief, for instance, Your Honor, I say that the manufacturers of Ritalin have recognized that it can fuel and trigger and heighten the kinds of conditions that Mr. Wall suffers from. It can trigger psychoses. And that's why they added the label some years later.
Well,
but
all these doctors opined that he was psychotic. No question.
That's correct. I don't think that we can, as lawyers and judges, say, if I have an expert in a case and I don't give them all the information, then I don't see how I can be effective as a lawyer, nor can I see how that expert could be complete in rendering an opinion. That's all we're asking for.
What information would, because here it's not the lawyer giving the expert information. The expert has the information. The expert knows what Ritalin's impact on the bipolar disorder. That what information, after arguing that the layperson should have given the expert information that the expert already would have known as part of his expertise?
Well, Dr. Cook says that he was unaware of it, that while Mr. Wallace may have told him that he believed it was the ramblings of someone. Never brought it to his attention.
Dr. Sadoff states explicitly on page 4 of his June 9, 2000 report that a psychiatrist named Dory Middleman, who would prescribe for him, he states she prescribed Paxil and Ritalin. So at least as of June 9, 2000, one of the experts early on in this case, Dr. Sadoff, had knowledge explicitly that Mr. Wallace had prescribed for him Ritalin. And this is after the period in the 90s when the FDA went so far as to require a relabeling
of Ritalin, didn't it?
Yes, that's my information.
Because of, at least, the effects that were determined it had on young children who had a pre-existing psychosis.
So Dr. Sadoff, never noted that Dr. Middleman prescribed Ritalin PRN, which is as needed, which I think certainly got Mr. Wallace into trouble. So he was essentially taking it whenever he wanted. I think that's a huge factor here in explaining why his psychosis, according to Dr. Bebo, spun out of control, and that he recommended a review.
Judge McKee, do you have further questions, Judge McKee and Judge Ambrose?
I do. On actual innocence, you argue that Mr. Wallace can show actual innocence through involuntary intoxication. But are you aware of a single case where a Pennsylvania court has allowed that defense in a non-DUI situation?
Your Honor, I will acknowledge that the Pennsylvania courts have not dealt with this extensively. Your question, no, but it does not mean that if I give someone, or if my client takes a bunch of pills that's being prescribed by him and that causes him to act in a certain way, that that's not relevant for the case. And the Pennsylvania courts wouldn't recognize that as a defense. Again, I think the involuntary intoxication would be more akin to a temporary insanity.
Which actually leads to my second question on this point. Why wasn't the defense insanity?
Well, at the time, the experts who were evaluating Mr. Wallace said that he understood the wrongfulness of his conduct.
They explicitly said this is not a McNaughton case, didn't they?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It would seem that there are two time periods you look at. At the time of the trial and the competence of the people who assisted the counsel at trial. And I guess what they were saying based on those reports is at the time of the committing of the crime that they did not believe they could meet the elements of insanity. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
There was opinion by all experts that said that he was not at that point. Again, he was not with the Ritalin. And I would say that just to address an earlier point that the judge, in this case, the trial judge, when faced with a motion to exclude evidence of insanity, denied that and said that he would allow any evidence regarding insanity, which very well, if the link between Ritalin and his psychosis was explored and investigated, could have been presented to a jury at a trial, but it never was. I think that's the crux of the matter here, is that it could have been presented. And it was not. That's new reliable evidence. That's something that the trial counsel did not do.
So the bottom line of your argument has to be then that there would be expert opinion that would state that Ritalin can lead to such an exaggeration as to constitute insanity. Isn't that the logical extension of your argument?
Your Honor, I think looking at the context of the other evidence in this case, we would say that Ritalin would Ritalin would be insanity because of the other indications of religious fueled psychosis religious oriented psychosis that it was a result of stimulant use.
Any further questions, colleagues? Judge McKee, Judge Ambrose, any further questions? If not, we'll take the case under advisement. It is interesting. It is important. Thank you, Mr. Saylor. Thank you, Mr. Casenta. This argument is complete.
completed. Thank you. Do you